If you were only half listening, you might think that comic Sarah Silverman was racist. But if you're really listening, you're likely to laugh out loud at her humor, which skewers racism, anti-Semitism, and stereotyping. A recent profile in The New Yorker said, quote, Silverman crosses boundaries that it would not occur to most people even to have. The more innocent and oblivious her delivery, the more outrageous her commentary becomes, unquote. Rolling Stone and Entertainment Weekly have called Silverman the funniest woman in America. She has a new concert movie of her stand-up act. It's called Jesus is Magic. She's also featured in the comedy documentary The Aristocrats and has appeared in the films School of Rock and There's Something About Mary and the TV shows The Larry Sanders Show, Seinfeld, and Mr. Show with Bob and David. Here's a sample of her comedy from her new film.
Like, I don't want to be labeled as straight or labeled as gay, you know, I just want people to look at me and see me, you know, as white. And, you know, that sounds, I can say that, by the way, because I used to go out with a guy who was half black who totally broke up with me because I'm a f***ing loser. And, I just heard myself say that. So, I'm such a pessimist. I have the worst attitude. He's half white. And he totally broke up with me. And it's funny now, like what is it? Hindsight's 2020 or whatever. Like, I know, it's so obvious to me now why he broke up with me, you know, because he has low self-esteem, you know? And I can't compete with that. Like, everybody knows somebody who, it's like anything you say to them, they're gonna take it, they're gonna hear it in the most negative way. You know what I mean? And he was like, you could give him a I gave him a compliment, all right? I told him he probably would have made like a really expensive slave in the olden timey days, not now. And what does he do, right? It goes through the Rube Goldberg, you know, crazy straw of his low self-esteem, and it hit his ear, and he heard something up, you know? I can't control that. Like, I can't control what he hears, you know? He has to learn how to love himself, you know, before I can stop hating his people, you know? As a people. I don't care if you think I'm racist. I just want you to think I'm thin.
Sarah Silverman, welcome to Fresh Air. I think your movie is really funny. I'm wondering how often people think that you're genuinely racist or homophobic or anti-Semitic or whatever.
Not often. It doesn't happen often, but it certainly happens. I mean, probably more often than the average person. But, yeah, I have an old boyfriend who would call it mouthful of blood laughs. Where their audience was just completely laughing at the wrong thing, not understanding any of the irony or, you know.
Now, why do you want to work that territory?
It's the stuff that makes me laugh. It's subject matter that is interesting to me. It's, you know, for me, like, taboo stuff and, like, elephants in the room is, you know, I'm not brave or something. I'm just, you know, to me, it's like, I don't know how everyone wouldn't be interested in talking about this stuff. It's you know, the exciting stuff to talk about. It's, you know, global gossip, you know.
You got in trouble with one Asian American media watchdog group. The head of that group didn't like you using the five-letter word that starts with CH. It's just a derogatory word to describe Asians. So you used that on Conan O'Brien, I think it was?
Yeah.
So what happened?
It was simply a joke about racism. I had to say the most racist word I could say on television. And, you know, they said, well, could you say Jew instead? And I thought, maybe dirty Jew would be like I could. But it wasn't good enough because I'm Jewish and it becomes self-deprecation and it had to be racist. And it was the whole point of the joke, and anyone who heard it, for the most part, understood that there is a context to it. And
so what was the thing that you, what was the bit of your act that started the controversy?
Joke, yeah. The whole crazy joke is this. I got a notice in the mail for to do jury duty, and I really didn't want to do jury duty. And you have to fill out this whole form and then send it in, and then you're randomly chosen. And I did not want to do jury duty. And a friend of mine said, you know, why don't you just write something really racist on the form, like, I hate chinks. And I thought to myself, yeah, you know, but I don't want people to think I'm racist. I just want to get out of jury duty, you know. So I wrote, I filled out the form and I wrote, I love chinks.
Well, that's funny. And it's a joke. I mean, it's a joke all about racism and you don't get it.
Your clearly, I'm the ignoramus.
Exactly,
yeah.
You're the ignoramus. Yeah, yeah. So the protest did not get you to rethink your humor. You're just sorry.
No,
that...
I mean, I dropped the joke because I ended up having to say it so many times in on Politically Incorrect and stuff like that. It just became old news, you know. But no, I mean, it was a reaction to a buzzword with no context even being considered, you know. So I can't, you know, even trying to defend it just implies guilt of some sort, you know.
In your act, you talk about having been a bedwetter until you were about 15. This is a very embarrassing thing to talk about. Why go there?
Well, I don't know. I guess I grew up really believing that this would be the deepest, darkest secret of my life, you know. You never think as a child who's a bedwetter that you would ever tell anyone, ever, you know. And then you grow up and it's, you know, it becomes just a part of your life and a part of what makes you, a part of what informs who you are, you know. And, there's a certain amount of pride and there's a certain amount of, you know, some, I'm sure, unhealthy need to expose myself, you know. And I mean that literally. But also, you know, there's something about it that feels good, you know.
Now, you also do jokes about, you know, your family. You do jokes about Jimmy Kimmel, who's your boyfriend. Now, being a couple where you're both comics, you and Jimmy Kimmel, like when you do something together and you share an experience and you both have funny perceptions about that experience that you've shared, who owns the experience? I mean, say you both want to do something about it in your
act. We've never had that. We've never come across that. I mean, sometimes I've lucked up by being able to, you know, I am an R-rated comic and he's on ABC, which is owned by Disney, so... Even if he comes up with something great, often it's nothing he could use. So I have no you know, I've already, I'm an established comedian. I, you know, write my own material and I feel confident enough in my persona to say, yeah, I'll take that. I could definitely use that. That's a great joke, you know.
Now, a lot of our listeners probably saw you in the movie The Aristocrats, which is a documentary about how different people tell a joke that's basically the premise of a joke, and then each comic who tells it kind of does these really obscene riffs on the premise. Have you always been comfortable speaking that blue in front of people?
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm one of those kids that, you know, my dad thought it was, like, really hilarious to teach me swear words as a toddler. And it's funny, you know, I think that I would say them and the reaction I would get would be so fantastic that I think it, I searched for more and more and more, you know, and... I was kind of farmed that way, you know. My parents, you know, my dad swears he's the sweetest man, but it's just a part of his language. It's like, you know, or totally, but it's the F word.
So is it supposed to be really cute for a little toddler or a kid to be using words that we can't say on the radio?
apparently in the 70s it was adorable too. Adorable. So because of that, I think I've had this kind of comfort with, at least with language. I don't even think of myself that I don't swear particularly a lot, but just raised in a family that was, didn't have maybe the same spectrum of boundaries, it was bigger, you know, the wider. I'm not a oddball in my family. We're all freaks in that way, you know. So I think that I was always kind of comfortable saying that. I think the race stuff was stuff I was not comfortable with until my 20s, you know, because I, you know, for all the right reasons, you know, if someone said something racial, even in a joking way, it upset me. I remember a friend of mine who was a comic put a nickel on his forehead and said, "Hey, look, Jewish Ash Wednesday." You know, he's Jewish, you know, the Jewish Ash Wednesday. And of course, today I would, you know, it's hilarious, but I was like 19, you know, I just started doing stand up, maybe even 20, and I would get so upset. And it's funny how I've changed, you know, and maybe because of that, you know, I was so affected by race and stereotypes that I kind of, even though it was never mine to begin with, I think I kind of took it back. You know what I mean? Like a take back the night, but the night was never mine.
Well, were you exposed to a lot of racism or anti-Semitism as a kid?
No.
No,
I have no license to be doing what I'm doing. You know, I didn't grow up in an all-black neighborhood or something. I'm not black myself. I grew up a Jew where there were no other Jews. But the only thing I can remember from my life is like in third grade, a kid on the bus threw like pennies at my feet and said, you know, "Pick them up, Jew, like you're a cheap Jew," or something like that. But it was so innocent, you know. I mean, it's a kid doing it. And of course, I didn't have that perspective then. But at the same token, he became my little third grade boyfriend probably a month later.
Oh, really? Did you even get did you even get it then?
Yeah, I did. I was like, yeah, Jews are cheap. Ha ha ha. I don't know. You know, I was raised in a place where there wasn't, you know, people weren't racist. I mean, it was a time in, you know, the 80s or whatever, where in a world that was very white, and there were no Jews, but I didn't feel threatened at all. So even when that happened, I was just kind of like, it's weird. You know, I don't know. But, you know, my dad grew up in a very different world. You know, he was beaten up and abused brutally, you know, for being Jewish.
Did he tell you stories about that when you were young?
Yeah. Yeah, he was sent to a prep school. You know, his parents did well, you know, but it was like a, I don't know if it was some sort of Christian prep school. It wasn't. And, or it was just not, there were not Jews there. And kids would like encircle him, you know, and call him, you know, kike, dirty Jew, all that kind of stuff, and beat him up. And, you know, this was in New England, either, it must have been New Hampshire, I think, by then. And they would go have ski teams or whatever. And one time they were all bullying him on the snow, and he stabbed a guy in the stomach with his ski pole.
Yikes.
Yeah, and got suspended for it, of course. But, you know, it's so sad. You know, you want to kill those kids. My small experience with racism was just in a time where it didn't threaten me in any way. I wasn't in a world where it was threatening. But, you know, when I hear the stories that my dad tells, it's so heartbreaking.
Now, one question about your father. Your father used to own the Junior Deb Varsity Shops. Did he just own a couple of, in, like in a franchise of them?
Yeah, it was a small chain of boys and girls clothing that his father owned. And then he sold them and kind of retired so that he could write, because his real passion is writing. And wrote some novels. And then ran out of money. I had to open a store again, and opened a store called Crazy Sophie's Factory Outlet, a discount women's clothing store. And he did his own ads on the radio.
No,
and they're hilarious.
Oh, really?
Well, he's got this really thick Boston accent. I mean, you can really hardly understand a word he's saying. And he'd be like, "This is Crazy Donald, Crazy Sophie's husband." It's a made-up name, though. He'd say, "When I see the prices at the mall, I just want to vomit. Come to Crazy Sophie's. We got Unicorn, Wrangler, this, that, all these, like, kinds of jeans you've never heard of." And then at the end he says, "So if you care enough to buy the very best, but you're too cheap, come to Crazy Sophie's."
That's really funny.
Yeah. And then on the other side of the spectrum is my mom, who's from Connecticut and speaks perfectly and says, you know, things like when and where. And she went to the local movie theater and complained that she could not understand what the person was saying when she called up to find out what movies were playing on the recording. And they said, "Oh, you want to do it?" And she was like, "Okay." So I grew up with her, you know, going with her to the movie theater and to the little booth where they kept all the not fresh popcorn. And she would say, "Hi, and thank you for calling Bedford Mall Cinemas. 1, 2, 3, and 4 were all bargain matinees. Are only $2 Monday through Saturday." So
that's great.
Different. Well, but showbiz family. Yeah.
Neve said that you think most comics are filled with self-loathing. Does that describe how you felt about yourself when you were young?
No. No, I didn't. I had a. I've always had a pretty healthy self-esteem. You know, I mean, I think I'm sure I'm riddled with insecurity as well, but I like myself. I've got a pretty good self-esteem. I think, like, my comedy came more from humiliation and from, you know, I say it in the movie, but it's kind of true. It's like I was a chronic bedwetter. You know, I had this deep, dark secret. You know, if I had to go to sleepover parties, I would, like, just pinch myself awake all night. You know, I was, you know, the one thing about being Jewish, and the thing that made me feel the most Jewish, because we weren't religious in any way, was that I was so friggin' hairy compared to these, you know, Carol Reed, L.L. Bean, blonde Aryans that I lived with, you know. So there was that kind of, you know, you want to be funny. You want to be funny before anyone is funny on your behalf, you know. Or, you know, one time I have Elvis Presley's death to thank for a party in first grade, a sleepover party at Heather Paul's house. And for some reason, I had no sleepover clothes. I had to borrow her pajamas. I slept, you know, in a sleeping bag, soaking wet the next morning. And just kind of paralyzed with fear, didn't say anything or do anything, and changed with the other girls, you know, changed into my regular clothes and just left the clothes kind of on the floor there. And her mother came in. She was so mean. And she stepped on my pajamas and she was like, "Who did this?" And I was just, my heart was just pounding. I was so scared. And right then her husband came in and said, "Elvis Presley just died." Thank God.
Now, you were on Saturday Night Live very briefly. Was it like one season?
Yes.
In 93?
93-94 season. I was 22. Totally not ready to do something like that. I knew it, too. I remember I found out at the Man's Chinese Theater, my manager told me, and I went to the bathroom and I was peeing and I thought, I will be so much more ready for this in years to come, but what am I going to do, say no?
How much material did you get on?
almost nothing. A couple sketches that I wrote with other people. A few sketches I wrote with other people. Nothing like that is...
memorable?
Nothing memorable. Yeah. Nothing memorable. But where I really did well was at Punch Up on Thursdays. Thursday from noon till about 7 a.m. the next day, we would punch up all the scripts that were chosen for the show that would be in dress rehearsal. And we'd go through each one and punch it up and add jokes and stuff and rewrite it. And I was good at that. I contributed a lot to that.
So what did it do to your professional sense to have this big break and be a writer and in the cast of Saturday Night Live and yet get very little material on the air?
Well, I always, you know, I'd always say to myself, because like Adam Sandler and David Spade and Chris Farley would, they kind of, I remember them saying like, oh, the first year, first couple of years, you never get on, and it's just part of the dues. And so I'd always be like, ah, first year dues, you know. I wasn't, you know, my expectations were not high, you know, and for myself, you know. And but then there was never that second year, so.
Did that hurt your confidence?
Yeah. For a good year, I had no confidence. I didn't even feel like I was in show business. I just didn't know who I was. It was a real identity crisis, kind of. I thought I was going to get fired from everything I was ever hired. But it was really like a broken bone, you know. It was like when I came out of that year of feeling so rejected and being fired from something, there was really nothing that could faze me after that.
How would you describe your onstage persona now?
I feel like I've gotten to I think that doing stand-up all these years, you're kind of striving to find yourself on stage and to be yourself on stage, you know? And I think that despite what you might think, I'm completely myself on stage. I mean, you always strive to be more, but in terms of the way I talk, my body language, you know, the words I choose and everything, it's pretty conversational and it's pretty much how I talk. And I like that, you know. Internally, it's different. You know, it's a little bit more of a character. It's, you know, I mean, I'm playing someone who's more ignorant and arrogant.
Exactly.
A great combination of ignorant but also totally arrogant. And I like to think that that's not necessarily me. I'm ignorant but not as arrogant.
Do you think that being a woman stood in your way at all when you were starting out? Because I don't really make the round of the comedy clubs, but I think of a lot of the comedy clubs as having a lot of, and this might be completely coming out of ignorance, but having a lot of male comics who make a lot of jokes about women and sex and that.
No, because I think you make jokes about what you're thinking about and your life experience, and that never affected me or bothered me. I made jokes, you know. I lost my virginity as a comedian, so my act became all about sex for a while, you know, because it's just all you're thinking about, you know. And I think I never really felt like a woman. I mean, there are individual little stories and snags that there was frustration. And I'm sure in the beginning, you know, like I play basketball, you know, I used to play a lot more, but I know that kind of feeling. It's just like being a woman comic and having to prove yourself with a new set of peers, you know, where you like go to the YMCA for a pickup game, and those first couple games, it's that anxiety of having to prove that you can, that you play hard, you know. And I think that it can be that way with being a woman in comedy or anything where the majority of people in that field are male, you know. It's there's nothing, nobody's doing anything wrong. It's just human nature. But I've only ever been a woman in stand-up or in life at all, and so I have nothing really to compare it to. It's been been quite a ride. No, it's been fine for me.
Sarah Silverman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Silverman's new comedy performance film is called Jesus is Magic. It opens this weekend in New York and Los Angeles and will later open nationally. Here's a song from the film.
1, 2, 3, 4.
I love you more than bears love honey. I love you more than Jews love money. I love you more than Asians are good at math. I love you even if it's not hip. I love you more than black people don't tip. I love you more than Puerto Ricans need back.
You can hear another song from Sarah Silverman's new movie on our website, freshair.npr.org.